This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
This week on our Masters in Business podcast, I actually have a really special guest. I know I say that every week and you guys make fun of me, but this is a really special guest. His name is Art Sandberg. He is a legend amongst both hedge fund and venture capital investors. He has a phenomenal track record. When he began, his hedge fund was one of less than 100 funds that were in existence. And he briefly, he tells the story how he gets a call from the Wall Street Journal to find out that his hedge fund is apparently George Soros had retired and Julian Robertson had retired. And suddenly he's running the biggest hedge fund in the world at the time. And not that that was his design or his focus, but it just kind of happened. He's a fascinating guy. He's literally a rocket scientist, an aeronautical engineer who used to work on missiles and satellites and things like that before he moved to Wall Street. He tells some of those stories, and they're quite fascinating. Our conversation about venture capital investing and the areas he's looking into is really quite amazing. And, you know, you guys by now know I'm not afraid to talk. Most of the time during this conversation, we're just sitting. I'm just lobbing questions and listening in rapt attention as to what he said. It wasn't until later in the podcast I actually come out of my shell. But the elephant in the room is, it's public knowledge. There was an SEC investigation. It was started, it finished, it reopened again. Ultimately, he ended up settling without admitting or denying, paid a $28 million fine, I think it is, and as the SEC tends to do, had him sign a non-disclosure agreement or something to that effect. So we really couldn't get into that in great detail, but I did bring it up, and he did respond, I thought, in a rather forthright way, as much as he's allowed to say, he said. Really interesting guy, fascinating background, and some of the stories he tells they're just amazing. So sit back and brace yourself for our couple of hours with Art Sandberg.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
This week on Masters in Business, I have a very special guest. His name is Art Sandberg, and he's been running various hedge funds and venture capital funds for a good couple of decades, posting fairly spectacular returns. I'm only going to give a short version of your CV because it will take up the whole segment. Otherwise, launched a hedge fund. It was Dawson Sandberg. Not
it was Dawson Sandberg.
Originally, back in 86. Back when there was 50 hedge funds, something like
That's the number I made up, but it's under 100.
It was a small number of hedge funds, put up returns over the life of his funds of almost 18%. And the interesting thing about Mr. Sandberg, doesn't come from the traditional business economic background. Undergraduate, Bachelor's of Science in Aeronautics and Astronautics from MIT, and then a master's degree in those subjects from Stanford. So really, you're a rocket scientist, aren't you?
I was.
You were a rocket scientist.
I no longer am.
And then you end up getting your MBA from Columbia. We'll talk a little bit about some of your classmates at Columbia. There's some really interesting stories there. You currently are the chairman of the MIT. Sits on the board of advisors of the MIT Energy Initiative, and you were chairman of the MIT Investment Management Company.
Correct. And I sit on the executive committee. And I'm very, very involved in the school.
There's so many other things and so many other titles you have. You're very active in philanthropy and a variety of other things. We'll get into that as the show goes on. Let me just start by saying welcome to Bloomberg.
It's great to be here. Thank you, Barry.
So first, I have to ask, you were at Lockheed Missile and Space Company in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. You come to New York, you get your MBA from Columbia. And then you end up working as a security analyst at Kidder Peabody. Mm-hmm. How do you transition from literally rocket scientist to financial analyst?
You got to follow your passion. You got to follow your competitive advantage. And I quickly found out that I could solve the equations, but I had no idea what was really going on. I worked in missile attitude control. So these were
define missile attitude control.
So the U.S. launches rockets. Satellites come off of those. They look down on Russia back then, and they have infrared sensors, and they find out where the Russians are launching rockets. And mm-hmm. there's a lot of orbital mechanics. And I could solve the equations, but did I really have any clue as to what was actually going on? I quickly found out that I did not.
So you go to Kidder Peabody, you're covering aerospace and those sort of companies.
Yeah, it's sort of interesting how I made the transition. I wasn't going to go to graduate school, but Lockheed would pay for it. So I said, sure, you're going to pay for it, I'll do it. So I went to Stanford, and it was during the day. And on the way back, I would stop off at a brokerage office. And it was the time when CompSat went public.
Oh, sure.
Now, that's something I know something about.
This is
satellites.
What, the 1960s?
Yeah, I got out of MIT in 62, and I was working as an engineer from 62 to 65, mm-hmm. someplace in that time period. CompSat launches, the company goes public, and I'm fascinating. It's like, my goodness, all the stuff that I know I can apply to making real money.
As opposed to
working
dollars.
My way up the engineering right. ladder, where I had no illusion that I would ever be great.
That was a good middle class job, but you're never going to make the real bucks over that.
My dad was an electrician.
Mm. So you were making more money than your dad when you were working for Lockheed.
Absolutely.
So then how did you go from there to Columbia?
Because my wife needed to get a job teaching school.
In New York?
Any place. And the only place I knew for sure she could get one was back in New York because I knew some people.
Sure. So you go to Columbia,
yep.
and this is a rumor, and you have to tell me if this is true. You used to carpool to Columbia with two guys named Mario Gabelli and Lee Cooperman?
It's no rumor. It's the actual truth.
That's a lot of intellectual firepower in that vehicle.
I learned more in the carpool than I did at school. don't tell the school I said that.
Okay.
I co-chair the board there, too.
By the way, the school that you're dissing right now, you made the biggest donation in their history to their graduate program, didn't you?
It's been exceeded by a couple of other guys now, but
people
it was a large. No, my success in life is taking a decent expertise in technology and combining it with finance and trying to apply those two things to help companies aggregate capital and grow and create jobs. And so I'm one of those guys who believes in all of that good stuff.
Are there many people who don't believe?
There are a lot of people who don't believe.
I think people believe it. They just get offended by some of the gross excesses that occasionally erupt.
I think they're also jealous.
There's possibly an element of that.
Yeah.
So one of the things, we've had Lee Cooperman on. I know you mm-hmm. guys are friendly. One of the things that Lee talked about was how he developed his deep value framework
right.
from Columbia.
Right.
What was your experience like?
My experience was I was the antithesis of deep value.
Okay.
I remember Mario, Lee, and I... Mario and I took a course from Roger Murray, who was the guy
sure.
who reinstituted the value investing stuff at Columbia. He got one grade higher than I did because it was analysis of a company where it turned out that the really key factor was the old man who found it was going to die,
mm-hmm.
and then value would be created, which Mario was fantastic at.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was disgusting. I mean, I really am interested in people who are alive and doing things.
You care about the technology. You have the physics background.
I care about solving the world's problems and getting rich while doing it, because I think the two actually do work together.
Well, many people who have created solutions to pernicious problems have not only helped society, but created a tremendous amount of wealth along the way.
I think that's the American way, and I think it's phenomenal.
You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. We're speaking with Art Sandberg. He is the founder of Pequot Capital Management, and now he's running Hawks Financial, venture capital, and
Hawks is a umbrella
family office, venture capital, all stuff.
We do have a fund though that my older son is now the managing partner of. We call it Acadia Woods, and it's increasingly showing up in the holdings of some very interesting companies.
Oh, that's fascinating. Let's talk about. We mentioned earlier less than 100 hedge funds when you launched.
I believe.
And the fund returned a rather smart, by the way, that's very similar to Lee Cooperman's returns, 17.8%.
Lee is a great friend. Mine's better.
I think you're about half a percent ahead.
Well, and I will say, because I believe that numbers are numbers, and you don't fool with numbers. I was, I did go to MIT. But my first year, I was down 26%.
You were down huge. I want to talk about
that. So if you were to adjust it, like most people have, up 100% first years when they're
teeny.
Then the
money pours in, right?
And then the money pours in, and then depending on when you came in, you might not have even made money with one of these guys with a great record. Not true here.
The dollar-adjusted returns, not the time-weighted returns,
right,
for a lot of big funds are awful. Because they were putting up 80% returns with $20 million. Yeah. Then they're at $45 billion and they lose a third.
Yes.
So net, over time, they're a dollar loser, but percentage-wise, on a time-weighted basis.
I've never had the chance to say this before, but that is absolutely not the case at Pequot.
So you were down 26%, and one of your quotes that I really like was, you learn more from your disappointments than you do from your successes.
You do.
Explain.
Success feeds on success, and people are there to tell you how wonderful you are. People don't really, unless
money attracts money is money the expression my money. Mother used to tell
you
me.
Bet.
And I never understood it until a few years ago.
And if you do that for a long enough period of time, my belief, clearly my belief, is that people then want to start to tear you down. They either want to continue to build you up or tear you down.
Mm-hmm.
And
you become
a high profile target. So you're not going to hear a lot of things you believe about what you're doing wrong when you're doing right. But you are doing things wrong. And
all the time.
And then if you just go into a shell and you don't realize and self-analyze and really look carefully at what you did and why it failed, you will not do well. So after I was down, because that was the crash of 87, and it was brutal.
You had launched, what, a year earlier?
It was down 26%. Yes,
right.
I launched a year
earlier.
Oh, so
you did worse than the crash?
That
was a one-day thing.
No, it was a one-day thing.
The market was up almost 41% and ended
Correct.
Up returning 1% for the
Correct.
Year.
Correct.
That was a big, big downdraft.
It was brutal. And I remember having to, because I when I started the fund, it was to invest in small companies that were overlooked that could become big companies. Those are exactly the kind of illiquid positions that got creamed.
I can imagine.
So I ended up assuming that I was going to get redemptions. I had to call companies and say, would you buy my stock? That is, if for anybody who knows anything about anything, that is not a good way to execute a sell program.
No.
But there were no other buyers.
Really?
So I got smoked. So it was up 3%. For my stub period in 86, and it was down 24, 25, or 26, I can't remember, percent in 87. But then it came roaring back.
So what was the subsequent couple of years? So in other words, you put up almost 18% a year despite starting from that hole.
So if you were to just do the simple math, it would take it up by...
probably closer to 20% if you backed
over,
out that
over,
year.
Over 20. The next few years were up 20, up 75 up. I mean, it's just, crazy numbers.
Right. In the late 80s, up 75%.
Starting back in 89.
Mm-hmm.
87, 88.
And then 96, 97, 98, 99, I can imagine.
Those were crazy years.
Just insane. What sort of numbers were you doing those years?
60%.
Just nuts.
But one of the things I did at Pequot was to realize that because I was sort of the first guy to really specialize in technology investing as a hedge fund.
Really?
Yeah, without a doubt. And I,
oh, that's fascinating.
So I started sector funds, and
uh-huh.
I had a great partner, Dan Benton, who then took over the technology stuff because I thought I had a broader background in the whole business and I could run the business and everything else. And he had a 100% year. I had a healthcare fund that was up 125% in that time period. We started an energy fund. So we had sector funds, and I devised a way for me to manage increasing amounts of money by using those talents and bringing them into the fund while still trying to do research myself.
In the early days of the fund, someone had written, and I don't remember where I'm quoting this from, that it was over $15 billion and kept growing. And at the time, that made it the biggest hedge fund in the world. Is that true?
You wake up and you wake up to unexpected news every once in a while.
Yeah.
And that's happened to me more than once in my life. But the unexpected news in this case was in the spring of 2000, we had a PR firm, and the PR firm calls and says, the Wall Street Journal is going to do a story on hedge funds now that George Soros and Julian Robertson have decided to close down to outside investors. And they have determined that you were the largest hedge fund in the world. And
serving outside clients at that point, otherwise.
Yes, sir. And they will do the article with or without your input. And we suggest you probably should tell your part of the story. I don't think anybody really, I mean, people on Wall Street knew who Peak What was.
Right.
But I don't like publicity. I like to just live my life, do my thing, give back. I believe I do give back. And I'm not out for self and aggrandizement. And so we were unknown. And then all of a sudden on a Monday morning or
bang.
Tuesday, bang, there it was. And my life changed.
Really? In what ways?
No, nothing positive.
So hence the low profile is the better way to go.
I've tried to maintain that ever since. And as you know, Barry, that was one of my reluctances about doing this.
I do know. And for listeners, I've been chasing Art down for the better part of a year. And after our conversation with Lee Cooperman, Lee eventually convinced you, oh, this guy isn't that bad. You should come talk
so
to him.
So far, you're okay.
So far, so good. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. My guest today is Art Sandberg. He is a former rocket scientist who became an analyst, hedge fund manager, and venture capitalist. Let's talk a little bit about your methodology, because we've already identified you're not a deep value investor like your friends Lee and Mario. Lee Cooperman and Mario Gabelli. What is your methodology when you're looking at either a public stock that you're thinking about buying or a private company that you're thinking about investing in?
It sort of starts from the same basis, which is what kind of change is possible, what kind of change can you find that is being implemented by smart people? It becomes more difficult, obviously, as a trend goes on and as you become larger in size. You really can't establish those positions. But initially, my fund was set up to invest in market caps, if you can believe this in this day and age, but we're talking 30 years ago now, of market caps under $200 million,
mm-hmm.
Yada, yada, yada. And then, of course, it changed.
30 years ago, under $200 million. Yeah. Today, that's still thousands of companies.
Yes.
But they trade by appointment. There's not a lot of liquidity over there.
Which is the only kind of things I own in my personal account right now. And I won't talk about any of those. But
illiquid.
I'm back
thinly
to being,
traded.
I'm back to being able to do what I first did when I
started.
When I started the business. Creating alpha through that cycle becomes difficult. And so that approach that I described, you have to evolve into a master of markets, as it were, to be able to go short, know how to use derivatives, appropriately match, you know, the cost of doing that to the potential upside. And that's become increasingly difficult for practitioners these days. And the results, quite honestly, have been pretty mediocre.
When we look at the small cap, there are guys like David Booth of Dimensional Funds who've created a very nice business focusing on the small cap advantage, the fact that you actually see outperformance from smaller caps versus the big, well-followed. There's an inefficiency among small caps that leads to
I think there's
potential
a
higher returns.
Growing inefficiency because we all know what's happened to employment in the brokerage industry. We all know how many companies are followed. It's declining all the time. The economics aren't there with the regulation. There are burdens on the companies plus the financial companies to follow them. So the value is definitely there. The problem is that nobody knows when you're going to get paid for that value. If David has managed to harvest some of these, more power to him. But some of the guys I know.
I think they're $300 billion now.
$300 billion?
At Dimensional Funds, yeah. Maybe it's closer to $400.
They buy a position in everything, don't they?
They have a quantitative model. They end up holding these things forever. I wouldn't say everything. They run through a number of screens.
Oh, no, I'm not denigrating what they do.
But basically,
it's very different than the model I'm talking about.
For sure.
I'm trying to identify winners, and there are, in my experience in life, there aren't that many winners.
So you mentioned earlier you're running your own assets as opposed to when you were running other people's money.
Yes.
How does that universe difference? What's it like running your own money versus what you have to deal with when you have outside investors?
It's very simple. You don't have to report.
Okay.
I do have to report to, I have two sons who I do it with.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a daughter who runs our family foundation, she and my wife. So in our family, the males make the monies and the females are a social conscience and help us give it back.
Mm-hmm.
So my boss is really the women in the Sandberg clan.
Okay.
They expect that I will always perform. I will perform well, and we will do great deeds for the world.
So you still like have tough. other investors to answer to.
But I can deal with that because they are my family.
So it's a little easier.
It's a little easier.
So we were talking about the increased regulatory environment and how things have changed from when you launched 30 years ago. Could you launch a fund today? Let's say hypothetically you're right out of business school today. What would it be like launching a fund in this environment?
Well, I guess in some ways it's easy. Well, talking about today, I don't really know because I haven't been that involved or involved at all. But at the peak of my success, it was simple for anybody to raise a fund. I mean, everybody was looking for the next great manager, and they'd throw money at them with fat return profiles for the manager.
Mm-hmm.
I think that welcome has been worn out.
Mm-hmm.
I know that welcome has been worn out. So now I think if you don't have a nest egg, you're not going to make it. So you better have made some money
before
and put it at risk in doing what you're doing. I certainly did that back when, because if you're down 20%, you can't really pay your bills. So
no.
you better have something to live on, and then decide whether you really want to take the risk for your family and everything going forward. I think you went through a whole generation of people who didn't have that risk. They just were having money thrown at them, and now there's a sorting out process going on. So I think it's much more difficult right now to sort a fund.
You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. My guest this week is Art Sandberg, probably best known for Pequot Management, although he has been a well-regarded venture capitalist and philanthropist over the years. Let's talk about running a business, what it's like to run an investment management business. I, some time ago, read a speech you had given, and you had talked about how challenging it is to find and hire the best people.
Mm-hmm. What? Without a doubt.
Why? How significant is that, and why is that such a challenge to an investment firm?
It's a challenge because there are a lot of smart people out there. So if you meet somebody and you talk to them, you're not going to think everybody's smart, but you're going to think a lot of people are smart. And
mm-hmm.
then trying to distill down those who appear to be smart into those who are going to be really effective in managing money, who are going to be easy to live with, because you have to live with these people,
mm-hmm.
Who aren't the kind of guys who become megalomaniacs and think that all the success is due to their efforts and not because of the team's effort.
Right.
Very, very difficult. Very difficult.
How soon after you make a key hire do you usually know if you're right or wrong?
Well, I won't do anything that the key hire tells me to do on the first recommendation.
Mm-hmm.
I always wait to see how that works out. Not because I don't believe in it, but I believe it's a far better learning example to pick that one apart about what went right, what went wrong. So
objectively, with no money at risk,
and then you progress from there. But the great fortune I had when I started Pequot was I hit a hot streak of hiring. And, you like to think it's all because of yourself, but I brought in Dan Benton. I brought in Mark Broach. I brought in Peter Dartley. I brought in Jerry Schindel. I brought in the first four hires that I made were spectacular.
Mm-hmm.
And Then it gets harder because they hire people and you hire other people, and all of a sudden there's a lot of people, and all of a sudden you're getting bigger, and all of a sudden you have back office issues, and all of a sudden every client wants to talk to you, right. And it's just very, very difficult to maintain your focus.
But those are good problems. Those are success problems.
No, they're
problems.
Great problems. I'd rather have those problems than not have them, but they are problems.
Right. Well, they're better problems than why is the fund doing so poorly, right. Why have 5 of your employees left, why, you know, those are bad problems.
Yeah, well, that's when you get into the point where so much money is coming in that the consultants control the, as they
right.
should. I mean, they have a fiduciary responsibility. But
do they? I'm not sure if consultants have a fiduciary responsibility.
The consultants don't, but the boards at hospitals,
okay.
the boards at educational institutions, whatever, they do. And they need the cover of the consultants. Not
who are
just
conflicted
cover,
and self-interested.
Cover is going to sound worse than it. That I intended
they
to.
Need the plausible somebody to point a finger at when things go wrong.
They also need somebody who's going to do it full time. I mean, usually the people who are on these committees are very, very busy.
Part time, you know, it's not a full time job.
Part time, they've got very active careers that they're very good at, and they have to delegate to somebody. So the infrastructure builds up. Anything that is successful creates either regulators, consultants, an infrastructure around that activity that is a challenge to people who are really...
It's a drag on future returns and,
totally.
And operations.
It's inevitable.
There's no way around that? I didn't know it was inevitable. I just always
it's
thought
inevitable.
It was...
Inevitable.
Okay. One of the themes that we've had in the show, I'm gonna change gears on you, has been the role of luck, whether it's in business or investing or even careers. Lee talked about this. Cliff Asness talked about this. A number of people, Bill Gross talked about this. What is the role of luck in building a firm and making investments? How does it affect people's professional careers?
I'm sure it's a major it's a major causal effect. But if you think about it, that's the biggest mistake you can make. I mean, I never thought about, boy, am I lucky. I mean, after I had achieved the success, perhaps I thought, "Bah, that was lucky." But you know, not while I was doing it.
You're doing it, what are you focused on?
You focus on your core principles. You know, what is it that you bring to the table that's different than other people?
Mm-hmm.
How do you build an organization around you that amplifies that competitive advantage, and stay, you know, and continue to learn and learn from your setbacks, all the things we talked about before. But to think that, I don't really believe it was because of luck. I think it was because I was driven.
Mm-hmm.
Did I have setbacks? You bet I had setbacks, but I viewed those as setbacks and things to overcome. Not like someday I'm going to get lucky, so I'm going to keep doing this.
So you really have more of an engineer's approach, which is here's the formula, we're going to plug and chug, and ultimately
totally.
You come out with the conclusion on the other end.
Totally.
So we have the Pope in town. That makes it appropriate to talk a little bit about charity and giving back. We've
right.
talked about that.
Right.
You have a number of philanthropic causes, organizations. You have your foundation. Let's talk a little bit about that. First question is, what are your philanthropic goals?
I don't know what the goals are, you know, to create a better world, yada, yada, yada. But a lot of this is formed by your life experience. So my mm-hmm. life experience is that my grandfather came over from Russia and Poland. One was a tailor. My dad, who was a very bright guy, was the oldest of 5. His father lost his job in the Depression, and he mm-hmm. he ended up becoming an electrician because he had to support the family. But we, you know, it was a strong family, and my parents did everything they could to help me get along. And so I got into MIT. Which is the ultimate in a meritocracy.
Mm-hmm.
You do the work, you do well. You don't do the work, I think it's a great institution. I think mm-hmm. I wish America reflected more of its core values. But I realized that, you know, I got to go there and all that. It was sort of somewhat random.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of people born in this world who have the same talents that I had, who are never going to have that chance. And I got to write that. I can't make the world perfect, and create equality across the board for everybody, but if I can affect the lives of a number of kids who don't have the opportunity I had because of just the way their family circumstances are, I want to make that difference.
So how do you express that in terms of philanthropy? What do you guys do with that?
We do that by supporting lots of startup venture, philanthropies that are in the area of education, healthcare. I could name names. There's the College Summit, Health Leads. We were instrumental in getting the two of those started. They're highly respected, and they're my daughter, who runs our foundation, will be annoyed at me if I forget all of them. I also, I'm Jewish and believe in the Jewish people, and so we were original investors in Birthright Israel.
As was your friend Lee.
Lee is an investor in Birthright Israel. We were one of the 14 founding families, and a number of other things. So it's those dual things, giving back to your heritage, giving back to people who don't have the opportunities you had, but certainly have the ability that you had.
How does that manifest itself in terms of scholarships or getting kids who might not otherwise get to a place like MIT to that sort of school?
I am told by the school, and I can't say this is true, that the scholarships I've given, I've given the largest amount of money in scholarships to MIT. I think that's true. My wife is very involved with Westchester Community College, and we're big supporters of Westchester Community College. Columbia Business School, which I co-chair with Henry Kravis, we've got a major campaign going right now to build a new business school up on the Manhattanville campus. I did a matching grant for 25 fellowships at Columbia. So it's not per se about buildings. It's about giving to the kids, giving to the professors. We have a program at Columbia Presbyterian or New York Presbyterian where we have a thing called the Sandberg Scholars in Pediatrics, enable them to hire a whole bunch more research people and fill in some gaps in there. And so the emphasis is on young people and health. And it's a pretty well thought out thing. My wife and I and our three kids are on the board. We take it very, very seriously. My goal, is to take care of my family, but if I die without a penny to my name, that would be ideal. Trying to figure out how you manage that is not the easiest thing in the world. But
so if someone wanted to find out more about the charities and philanthropies you support, is there a place they could go online to look at that, or is this all various meetings and committees and what have you?
We have a website for the Sandberg Family Foundation, which we don't ever talk about, so this is the first time I've ever mentioned it. That does not include schools that we went to and stuff, so everybody's responsible for their own alma mater. So it does talk to the kind of social things we are trying to do. We, as a word of caution, we do not accept incoming
inquiries.
We do our research and we go out and selectively pick what we want to do.
We've been speaking with Art Sandberg of Pequot Capital and the Sandberg Family Foundation. If you enjoy these conversations, be sure and check out the rest of our chat. You can find that on Bloomberg.com, SoundCloud, and Apple iTunes. Check out my column on Bloomberg View. Follow me on Twitter at Ritholtz. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You've been listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. Okay, welcome back to the podcast half. Now I don't have to worry about time. That, by the way, that's really annoying having
more
like I
time.
Have 3 minutes, 1 minute, 30 seconds. It's always in the back
right,
of my
right,
head.
Right, 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 right.
It's such a distraction. So a couple of things I didn't get to during the broadcast portion. Let's take up some loose questions, and then we'll focus on some of my favorite questions to ask during the segment. So I see a name like Pequot, which is an Indian tribe, obviously. How did you come up with the name Pequot Capital for the hedge fund?
Well, in hindsight, I wish I hadn't because
it's very distinctive. It stands out.
It was alliterative, Pequot Partners. It sounded good. It felt good. I had no idea the Pequot Indians were going to get a gaming license. And I remember getting letters from European investors about 8-10 years into the life of the fund saying, are you affiliated with that gambling tribe? No, I was at 354 Pequot Avenue in Southport, Connecticut.
That's how the name came out.
And it sounded alliterative. It meant nothing. I didn't want anything that suggested, you know.
Did you predate the casinos?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
They didn't come after you, did they?
They called me, and I said, well, just check the incorporation papers. It was 354 Pequot Avenue.
And that was it?
That was it. And it worked. So now, you know, Hawks, which is my family office, I live on a street by the name of Hawks. Acadia Woods, our family venture fund. We live on Acadia Woods Road in Northport, Michigan, which is where I spend my summers. So
you're in New York three quarters of the year, or half the year, and you're there?
About a quarter.
A quarter of the time?
In Michigan, yeah.
Yeah, so you're there just over the summer.
Over the summer.
What are the
beautiful
summers
spot.
Like in Michigan?
Yeah. Oh, it's awesome. We live down the beach from Mario Batali, who is a big champion of that area.
Really?
New Yorkers don't know.
The Italian tour. Is that what?
It ends up in Northport, Michigan, which is on the tip of a peninsula jutting into Lake Michigan. It's a beautiful, beautiful area. If you're a New Yorker, you go to the Hamptons.
Right.
Except if you're me, you go to Michigan. It's bizarre.
Mario Batali, the chef?
Yes.
Yes. So. But he's not from the – is he from that part of
No,
that?
But his wife went to University of Michigan and was friendly with a gal who grew up on that peninsula.
And that's where you are, right, over July and August.
And because I do venture capital now and I don't, you know, have to be – I don't have to have morning meetings. I don't have to – all of the paraphernalia about running a fund, I can do everything, you know, electronically and take plane trips to where I have to go.
How often are you on the West Coast, California?
About 6, 7, 8 times a year.
So we were just – in the beginning of this year, I was in Seattle for a week. Actually, a CFA event, I interviewed Howard Marks in Seattle, and then we spent a week in Seattle. Seattle is on fire. It's absolutely a city booming. And we just got back a few months ago from a week in San Francisco. It was a conference in Napa, and then a week in San Francisco is on fire. It's just
San Francisco has been on fire ever since I got out of school in 62.
Well, it waxes and wanes, but post-financial crisis, it was a little tamped down for a year or two, and it's just been booming.
For sure. Cyclicality is part of the human condition. So
how do you?
But it's also true in Denver. We have we started up a real estate development firm in Denver. Denver is another example.
Also booming.
Booming.
How much of that is related to the legal marijuana in Denver, and how much of it is?
Well, I'll tell you, the best investment has not been art. It has been buying up old warehouses in Denver
because that's where they
store the marijuana.
They grow it there also.
They have big warehouses, but they're big new and they need electricity and they need artificial light. But just the crummy old 100-year-old small warehouses.
Just to store. Bales.
I missed that play.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But I know it's true.
So you're doing a lot of venture capital work.
Yes.
How do you deal with the supposed valuation issues these days? All these billion-dollar unicorns, where do you focus?
I hope that I get into a unicorn.
Early.
Early.
So what sort of stuff do you like to look at as a VC?
Yeah, it's consistent with my background. My older son, who I work with, ran business strategy at PeopleSoft.
Mm-hmm.
He knows software far better than I do. I'm better at the physical sciences. We're involved with the fusion company that I really can't talk much about, but people should read the newspapers and
fusion in terms of energy generation
thorium.
Yes. I hope
no.
Why don't we have thorium reactors? You have a physics background.
Because we have a better approach.
Really?
Yeah.
Because thorium is supposedly.
Yeah.
And now my physics is 30 years rusty, but supposedly. Better than uranium, better than plutonium, no waste issues.
Well, plutonium is highly radioactive.
Yes.
I can't remember how radioactive thorium is. I looked at it a while ago. Well, what we're trying to do is fuse hydrogen and boron, and I won't bore everybody, but that results in three helium atoms and energy, and it's completely not completely, but largely aneutronic.
Right.
And you can
meaning no high energy particles leaving.
Correct. And therefore, you can build a commercial reactor. Unlike
what's the waste product like?
There's very little waste.
Really? So you're not left with...
There is waste, and we've got to take care of it.
Is it radioactive waste?
No,
or is it...
No.
So it's non-radioactive waste product out of a fusion.
And it's a major project, and...
You said you're trying to change the world.
I am trying to change the world. Plus, we're invested in a solar company that uses 3D Bristols, and it's a major breakthrough, and we're going through the last phases of proving out the technology.
On solar, I just had this conversation with someone not too long ago. On solar, all of the gains that we've seen have been so agonizingly, over 30 years, it's a substantial series, but they've been really incremental and evolutionary.
Yeah, this is not.
You're talking about a revolutionary change.
When I first met these guys, they were growing 3 million nickel nanofibers on a substrate per square inch.
A flat panel.
This is a three-dimensional panel where the photons come in and spiral down the bristles.
So you're capturing a lot more of the energy hits.
Three times.
Triple. This is an order of magnitude breakthrough.
Photons stay in the structure three times as long as if they were to just reflect off of a plane surface. So they stay in, and the efficiency goes up. It's hard to do, but we're almost there.
How much more expensive are these panels than traditional solar?
To produce? We're now making them on glass panels. I'll give you the answer to that in the first quarter of next year.
All right.
But
and none of these are open to outside investors. This is your...
No, this is, you know, I don't believe in sharing. This is risk.
Ailey, the work...
People should just stay tuned and
some really interesting things
coming
along.
Things coming along. And that's two of a number of others. So we do software companies.
When you were running Pequot, there was a lot of oil, energy, natural gas leases, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So energy has been an interest of yours
totally
for a long time.
Yeah, I had a bunch of sector funds, as I mentioned, but they were in telecom, they were in technology, they were in healthcare, small cap investing. The one exception was early on was in energy.
Mm-hmm.
Because I went, you know, if you lived in the 70s, you went through the oil embargo.
Sure. I remember as a kid trying to get a gas can filled up to mow the lawn.
Right.
And I would get the question, you know, what is your license plate, even or odd?
Right.
And I'm 11 and I have a gas can. Right. Well, I don't have a license. So, all right, give him a gas.
Well, no, they should have let the grass grow and give it to me. I mean, I was the adult with little kids. I needed it.
I had to mow that. Hey, listen, I had to earn a living. I was out mowing lawns.
I used to mow lawns.
So,
I used to deliver papers.
Same here. I hated delivering papers. It was a terrible, terrible job.
I had a bunch of friends, and two of them had routes. The one key guy who I bought a route with ended up being a sheet metal worker. He took a 50 paper route, which we split in half, 25-25, and he got it up to 100 customers. Mine dwindled down to 10 because I would sit on the curb and read the newspaper first.
Right.
And he just took the papers and delivered them. So, you know.
The best part about delivering newspapers was Sunday morning, me and a few friends who all had routes.
Right.
Would go to the diner and have breakfast at 9 o'clock.
There you go.
That was the highlight.
I didn't do that.
Maybe that would have been successful. That was the best part of it. So it sounds energy is really interesting.
Energy is really interesting. It is my belief that, you know, in 30 years, all the oil producing countries in the world will be bankrupt.
Meaningless. Basically back to managing their sand.
Back to sitting on a bunch of sand and rocks. You know, I hope to help.
You want to accelerate that process.
I want to accelerate that process.
Not
because I have anything against them. It's just that it's absurd that we're burning fossil fuels.
They're burning fossil fuels. They're not really sharing the wealth with the people of their country. When you look at all the problems we've had in the Middle East, I can't help but think if there wasn't oil there and we weren't so dependent on it, people wouldn't really care. We wouldn't have had various wars.
That could be true. I come at it just from a pure, you know, how can I help solve the world's problem, which is...
Making energy plentiful and cheap goes a long way.
There's no doubt. I mean, you know, I don't even want to get involved in the climate debate. I am on
What debate?
MIT. what the beta, you know, is carbon human generated or is it
whenever and I hear that, this just came up at a dinner the other day. I always tell people, if you don't think you can affect your environment, park your car in your garage, leave the engine running, shut the door, and spend an hour or two there.
I'd rather spend my time figuring out how to solve the problem rather than debate the issue.
I don't want to debate it either. I just say park in the car with park in the garage with the engine running, and we'll see how little you can affect your environment.
That is an argument. But I don't get involved in stuff like that. I get involved in what is the problem? What is the solution? Can I affect the solution in a positive way? And so
that's an engineering approach.
Yeah,
get away from it. What other issues lend themselves to an engineering solution that you can do venture investing with?
I don't know if it's a problem or what, but we bought up all the patents from AT&T in holographics.
Really?
So yeah, storage, you know, data storage is growing 40% a year, and will continue to grow at those kind of absurd rates for quite some time. So I'm involved in some flash memory companies. I'm involved in some new algorithms to try and make servers much more efficient. And I don't want to name names.
So there's a hardware approach and a software approach to solve that issue.
And we're involved in both. And what you really need is you need vast amounts of data on warm storage.
What is warm storage?
So, you know, hot storage is our disk drives, and to some degree flash memory. And cold storage are tapes, which are, you know, they just run sequentially. It's not random access. It's
ancient technology, or
it's ancient, but it's, you know, on a cost effective basis, it still makes sense. But you really want something that is nearer than tape, which will burn out in 5 to 10 years,
right.
Can have a longer storage life. I mean, our government goes out and has all these drones that are taking pictures of all kinds of stuff,
right.
God knows what. And they can't analyze half of it because there's no way to process it all.
So much of it.
And also, as you get into genomics and other things, we are just spitting out data. So if you could use holographic memories, which would last for 50 years, and down to the right price points, at any rate, so we're trying to develop that.
Interesting.
That is not an area where you can go out and talk to a venture capitalist and get them to, you know, go alongside you.
Mm-hmm.
Just won't do it because it's that area has been death to many, many startups. For our family purposes, we can take that risk.
Right.
It might take a little longer. We can take that risk. So we're trying to solve that problem. We're involved in medical devices and some medical some interesting companies.
You were on the board of a New York Genomics center.
Mm-hmm.
Before we get to that, because that's an area I find absolutely fascinating and would love to talk about, you're buying these patents up from AT&T.
Well, we bought them up.
It
wasn't from AT&T. There were two venture groups that did that.
What year did these patents come?
Well,
out?
these were done in the 90s, and
expired at this point, or are there enough?
No, because you keep refreshing them.
There's enough.
I mean, we keep improving the basic stuff. So we own all the patents. We have 250 patents covering both the way you store it and the media you need to produce it, Two venture firms poured $100 million into trying to develop this, and they
didn't
went
get
bankrupt.
Anywhere, right.
And we bought the asset out
so
of bankruptcy court. We bought, hopefully, this is a value play, right?
Anything you buy out of bankruptcy is usually.
Well, there's another one that we're involved with, which we did help somebody buy out of bankruptcy, which is Clear, which is at the airports.
What is Clear?
Clear is the. A biometric screening technique at airports and now they're starting to be incorporated. The Yankees just started using it. The San Francisco
at the stadium. So when I assume that everybody else, although they don't, I assume everybody uses TSA pre so they can whisk through the airport.
Yeah.
And then when you come back, there's global entry where you bypass all the customs
I have
and you.
That. beautiful.
Right? Yeah. So you take your passport, right, and then you take your hands,
right,
and you put that on a machine, and you're done in 30 seconds.
Right.
What does CLEAR do relative to that sort of...
CLEAR does the same thing, but...
Biometric.
Biometrics.
And it checks it against a giant database to make sure you're not a terrorist.
You are who you claim you are.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And so the Yankees are using this, and the San Francisco Giants are using this.
Yep. And increasingly, airports are using it. It's a company that went bankrupt, bought out of bankruptcy.
Good technology, but good bad technology. Business model and totally bad execution. Business models.
That was, in some ways, a value play.
Uh-huh.
But a value play based around superior technology with a bad go-to-market implementation.
Mm-hmm.
So we're involved in that.
We're involved
in tons of things.
These are really fascinating.
I love it.
Venture stuff. What other areas intrigue you from a venture perspective?
So there's alternative energy. There's software. There's one company up in Boston that we're involved with that...
I'm watching the wheel spin and you try and figure out what you can and can't say.
Yeah, exactly.
What subject does the technology cover?
The problem that companies like Hewlett Packard or Samsung or a bunch of them have is that the real money in smartphones and devices these days are in the apps.
Mm-hmm.
And there are two app platforms. One, of course, is Apple's. iOS,
mm-hmm.
iOS, and the other is the Android system.
Mm-hmm.
So if Hewlett were to come out with a new product and not support those apps,
you're giving up half the market.
Won't buy it. So some products have been introduced that are technically wonderful products, but they don't service the market as it is configured today.
Mm-hmm.
If you were able to solve that problem for manufacturers,
appify their software or appify their program,
basically, and you can emulate those things, but when you emulate, you have another microprocessor.
Right.
It's slow. It's inefficient. It just isn't competitive. If you can do it in what's called native mode using the application control layer, you can.
I'm looking to see if the word appify is taken because I want to. I think that's a word that I want.
You know, it's all yours. So at any rate, there's a company up in Boston that has done that. Samsung is incorporating its Tizen Z1 phone, which it introduced in India, and the future looks pretty bright. So there are software applications that are interesting because they solve problems.
They solve problems.
Yeah, I like solving problems.
So what else? I see why I keep speaking of problems. I keep searching for this, and I keep coming up with an Amazon Appify. Create the simplest Mac from a shell. So somebody else already has the the word Appify.
Sorry.
And then there's Appify Android apps on Google Play, at Appify on Twitter. So all right, I thought it was a good.
Ours has a different name. I won't even mention it.
Okay, don't mention the name.
There's another...
So you don't want to run an emulation because you're adding a whole other layer of software. It slows
totally.
It down.
Slows
and makes it
down,
more buggy, more complicated.
Totally.
So, but you make
but
it
if
native.
If you can do it off of the application control layer, it's completely legit, and it's
mm-hmm.
very hard to do.
Mm-hmm.
It's very hard to do.
So this is a software solution to a programming problem.
Correct. Yeah.
All right, what other areas intrigue you in terms of ventures?
There's a couple of bright young guys out of MIT who have come up with an active shock absorber system.
Shock absorber.
Yeah. The next
cars or for bicycles or for
cars. Cars. And maybe truck cabs, but right now the emphasis is on cars. And it's truly, so the trick there is to get it to a low enough cost
right.
that you can put it in automobiles. There are many There are systems today which use hydraulics.
The ferrofluids and
hydraulic. Yeah,
that's pretty old school, the hydraulic
stuff. It's old school,
stuff.
And it's very expensive per wheel.
Right.
If you can get it down with a simple system so that it would, sell for under $2,000 per automobile,
right.
There's a vast market. And
huge.
These guys, I think, have the solution to that. So So I'm on the board of that one. Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting.
So there's, you know, there's great stuff out there. So I am not one of these people who believes, oh my God, the world has a million problems. Let's stick our head in the ground and let's.
It does have a million problems, but it's got 2 million solutions.
That is my belief.
We go to this venture. It's really early stage, an angel conference in San Diego. I can't go every year or my head explodes. I go every other year or so. And you cannot come out of, and it's college kids and so.
Oh, yeah.
You cannot go through an event like that.
Well, they've told me, they've told me up at MIT that that in the generation or two ago, probably two, the average age of an MIT graduate who started a company was 42 years old.
And now?
27.
Yeah, I find you can't go to one of those events and leave and not be optimistic about the future.
It's amazing.
No matter how terrible things are, it's like, we're pikers. These kids are going to solve all these issues.
That is what keeps me going.
It's
that belief is what keeps me going.
I think I've told this story before. I was at a wedding in Virginia, or maybe it was a bar mitzvah. It was a family member. And it was a wedding because it was the groomsmen, couple of kids out of, I think it was UVA, down in Richmond. And one of them had an iPhone case that had built into it, this sounds idiotic, but it was genius, had built into it a bottle opener, like a beer, right? Built into the thing, so you take your phone and just pop a bottle.
Yeah.
And I said, oh, that's hilarious. You know, how are you guys going to make that? And they look at me like I have two heads.
Right.
Dude, we're doing 20,000 units a month. We have this manufactured in China. These guys are 20. They're in college.
Yeah.
Wait, you're selling 20,000 units? What do you charge for this? $14? What does it cost you? I don't know, 87 cents. The shipping is more. So when you see kids like that in college who are so I don't understand the consistent pessimism from people.
No, I don't either.
About the world is terrible, America is terrible.
No, I don't. Well,
you meet some of these kids, it changes your perspective.
They're the people who can't really relate to this kind of stuff, really don't like it, and therefore draw their own conclusions. They're not based on anything factual. I mean, the problem with all of this, of course, is the income divide between the people who can do what you just described and the people I've been describing, and
in
the rest
of
the
world.
In
terms of who you're trying to help, in terms
of
scholarships,
there is a huge problem developing.
In terms of income inequality, or in terms of opportunity inequality? Maybe that's an interesting.
Well, it's both. Some people will never be able to participate in this new world. Given
because
all the advantages.
They're just not tech savvy. They lack the skill set for that, or the interest, or
they might have the interest, but they're not going to be able to implement. And I believe that everybody should be given a chance to. So I will spend as much money as I can to try and help that.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a lot of people in this world, and not everybody can start these things. So, there are real social policy issues about how do you fix that. I'm not a social scientist, so I don't know. One of the reasons that we have emphasized things like fusion energy, solar, things like that, are because they address the basic problem, which is that unless you have cheap electricity or a number of other things, you don't grow world income. And if you don't grow world income, everybody fights over the pie. And if everybody fights over the pie, you're going to have a terrible world system. So I want to help people grow the pie. I would like to help in some of this carbon stuff if I can. I'd like to give part of the money back. I'd like to keep some of it to give everybody the opportunity to participate in that. It is then up to government to figure out the rest of it. And I see absolutely no movement towards coming up with any logical solutions to that.
Well, but that's the government discussion, that's easy. That's a long arc, and eventually government.
It's not easy.
What I mean by easy is over the next 10 or 20 years, my guess is that government incompetency, especially partisan incompetency, collapses under its own weight, and eventually.
What?
Eventually we're replaced with. I don't think the Republican and the Democratic Party are infinite in lifespan and here forever.
Mm-hmm.
I think these parties are slowly losing slowly losing membership, and you're going to end up with more and more people as independents. And that's how you end up with somebody like a Donald Trump, who really are hard to define by traditional party politics. Not a coincidence that what's going on today in the Republican Party, the appeal is the guy who's the least associated with the party. And the same thing is happening on the Democratic side.
Mm-hmm.
The Bernie Sanders is not a traditional Democrat.
For
and
sure.
Suddenly there's all this. So you have Trump and Sanders. The appeal isn't what their specific politics are. The appeal is that they're not traditional partisan players.
I agree, and I agree with your conclusion.
So I hope it happens.
As you go through that process of fragmenting the two, it's very painful.
Yeah, that's going to... So now let's talk a little politics, and let me force you to stop dancing around the carbon issue.
No, you'll never be able to force me to stop dancing
So
around.
Global warming, real?
I have no idea.
Get out of here. Come on,
no
how
idea.
Could you say that? You're a physicist. You're investing in fusion energy.
No, I'm not
energy.
A physicist. I used to be an aeronautical
You're an engineer. You have a ton of physics. You understand the scientific process. You know when 98% of scientists say something. You don't think that global warming is a genuine... Let's call it climate change.
I think the fact that there's so much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is a really, really bad thing.
How did it get there?
How did it get there?
Sunspots?
I don't know.
Cows? Volcanoes?
I don't know.
Burning carbon products?
Probably.
Okay. All right, so you've
But I don't know if it's solely because of that.
Nothing is solely because of anything.
I have friends who are on either side of this one, and I read it all, and I sit on this MIT Energy Initiative board.
Right.
At MIT, they have this guy, Richard Lindzen, who is a world-acclaimed climate mm-hmm. scientist who doesn't believe it.
Right.
There are many others, like
Tell
Hanson,
him to park
who do.
His car in the garage.
He's a very responsible guy.
Yeah.
And they're responsible people on the other side. I don't know. I mean, there are plenty of people arguing that, you know, that matter. All I know is I think that I can support some guys who have a solution to it.
Right.
I'd rather waste my brain cycles and energy and money on that rather than discussing
that.
It.
The debate, the argument is just wasted energy anyway. You're never going to, people aren't going to convince each other. By
no,
the way, when I say
it's religion. It's like a religion.
When I say I think that burning carbon and eating red meat, for that matter, contribute to global warming, I'm not saying that you shouldn't burn carbon and you shouldn't eat red meat. I have too many cars and boats. I eat lots of red meat. So I'm not.
You're a wreck.
No, I'm fine. I'm not lecturing people, hey, change your life. But I think it's hypocritical for people who know better to say, oh, just because we have a coal company and we fund research that says this has no impact, I'm not. I object to the hypocrisy of that. I'm not telling people change your life. Hey, you're affecting the world. Let's accept it and move on. I like your solution, which is to try and come up with a solution rather than digress into the debate.
It's all too complicated, and you're never, as you said, you will never change people's minds about this because it's become a religious fight, not. You know,
we're the
and,
only country
do you
in the
know
world,
that
by
5,
the way.
5 million people a year die from burning wood. I mean, so.
What do you mean in terms of the impact
worldwide.
On lungs or
yeah, effect on
or,
lungs.
Or what we see every winter where people take a kerosene heater and the fumes? You know, I joke about the garage,
but
burning stuff releases all sorts of noxious fumes.
Oh,
that's
horrific.
That's fatal.
It's horrific.
Yeah.
And so, you know. The people who believe that you should, you know, so the Union of Concerned Scientists, which mm-hmm. was born about 30 years ago in opposition.
Mostly about nuclear weapons,
opposition to nuclear weapons, but also, you know, nuclear power plants because mm-hmm. they were sort of, you know.
Hand in hand.
They just about 2 months ago reversed their position and said, you know, nuclear energy is the solution because there's no carbon dioxide. So,
right.
you know, if you live long enough, you watch all these convoluted
everything
things.
Comes
everything
around.
Comes around. You know, it depends on what the priority is and what the new religious zeal is.
Mm-hmm.
Advanced nuclear is legitimately back on the table. Thank God.
And much lower radioactive waste product than
no,
the old
that's
days?
The traditional old way of doing it.
Yeah.
And so we actually, another company we helped get started is in nuclear remediation. It's called Curion, K-U-R-I-O-N.
And what do they do?
They try and vitrify the waste product from nuclear fission plants.
And what does that do?
Lowers that enables you to bury it and store it. We're not all the way there yet, but in the process, we developed a media that will enable you to take cesium out of water, and that was
highly radioactive, very negative,
and became a huge problem in Fukushima. So we, as a small startup company, were the only ones who were able to get into Fukushima and help.
Oh, really?
And so something that was going to be like, you know, growing very slowly at first, just grew in size.
So,
and we've added other capabilities, and it's fascinating.
So Curium, like with a K, like Madame Curie?
K-U-R-I-O-N.
Oh, Curion.
Curion.
And so this removes radioactive cesium from water in order to clean
that's
up
that's the big
a
problem
nuclear
in Japan right now. It's right. not that people are dying and all that kind of
no,
stuff.
No, but you have potentially dangerous water working
correct.
Its way into
and you
groundwater.
Can't put it back in its,
and you can't stop it.
No.
Water finds its own level, and it's really a problem.
But we have been helping them fix that problem.
And this company is removing radioactive cesium from water in Japan today.
Yes, today. And has been for 3 years now.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow, that's fascinating.
And it was a startup. It was, met them, you know, three people back in 2009.
And so now? What's going on there
that's
now?
That's a good question.
You're an investor in this company?
Yes.
And how is it growing?
Oh, it's
this?
A home run.
Home run. What's the exit strategy for a company like that?
That's a good question. I'll tell you next time we talk.
Okay. Well, we'll have to revisit that. Any other VC stuff that's interesting before we move on to some
other
stuff?
I probably have.
You've said too much.
I've said too much, and I've probably caused too many eyes to glaze over.
All right. No. I can't tell you about other eyes, but I glazing over. But I find this sort of stuff.
Yeah, I love this stuff.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
There's a show on the Science Channel. So my background was applied mathematics and physics until my senior year in college, and I figured out that if I switch to poli-sci and philosophy, I can drink beer and chase girls and not have double labs for three times a week. And so I have enough physics and math to be dangerous to myself.
My best friend as an undergraduate is a brilliant guy who ended up being chairman of the biomedical engineering department at Hopkins for 17 years, world-renowned. And he helped me get through. He truly helped me get through. And whenever I would say I was really a very mediocre student at MIT, he'd say, oh, no, but when, you know, later on when you started taking religion and political science,
you really
knocked the ball out of the park. And I said, Murray, I don't think that's what MIT is all about.
Comparative religious studies at MIT,
it was great. Houston Smith was a professor.
Right.
He was world renowned. I mean,
right.
No, the MIT's got great,
for sure.
But you know, but that was not. But it was I learned so much from going there about applying yourself, overcoming obstacles.
Mm-hmm.
It's not an easy place. But
it's a very competitive place.
Very competitive, which I think is a great preparation for life.
To say the least. What I was going to mention, there's a show on the Science Channel called How the Universe Works.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially, it's really complex astrophysics
right.
with great digital graphics. So.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's what the inside of a neutron star looks like, but okay, that's close enough. It's a little more scientific than Industrial Light and Magic shows you on Star Wars. You know,
that stuff is
fascinating. So, speaking of saying too much, let's talk a little bit about the SEC. And I know this is an area I want to tread lightly. Let me bring up another guest. I had Mark Cuban on some time ago.
And, person I know well.
Let's talk about that a little bit. But Mark went off on an absolute jihad about the SEC, and he talked about how they're misfocused, misguided, unfair. He went off, and after the conversation, was like, "Are you sure you want to say this?" He's like, "No, we just won in court. We're done with them. They had to put their tail in between their legs and walk away." You had a not especially pleasant experience with the SEC. What do you think about what Mark had to say?
I know Mark. Before Mark made his first fortune, we worked together on a private investment I made. He's a very smart guy. He's obviously a very outspoken guy, very colorful guy. He was managing his own personal money. Mm-hmm. He didn't have the responsibility of managing money for, you know, for fiduciaries and have a lot of employees and everything. So I obviously am going to approach this in a far different way. Right. I did not.
He has to be less circumspect than you must.
For sure. And I did one of those settlement things with the SEC, neither admitting nor denying guilt. Mm-hmm. That was after the case was reopened. People will.
So like 9 years prison. It's like 2000.
It went on. I think they walked in 03 or 04, and it didn't get resolved until 09. It was resolved once where they
dropped it originally.
They dropped it, and there was a congressional hearing, and they actually made their notes available, their closing document, which is an internal thing, and I'm told by the lawyers it's first time ever. And then it got reopened, and it sort of got reopened right when Madoff happened. So you can
so come everybody to your, was going crazy.
You can come to your own conclusions as to, you know, what was going on. The case had to do with Microsoft, which is the most widely followed
sure.
company in the world. You know, there's really not much to say about it other than what I said at the time, which is this is too distracting. And that actually was a factual statement. Mm-hmm. It was extremely distracting. There were many things I thought I could do in my life. I was 68 years old. To fight from that point on would have taken another 3 to 5 years. And so if I had won, who's going to give money to a hedge fund guy who's in his early 70s?
Right.
It was a ludicrous battle to fight. And I thought I had a lot more interesting things to do with my life.
And it sounds like you certainly have been focusing on a lot
of things. I'm very happy about the decision I made. It's nothing you like to go to your grave with, you know, mm-hmm. and have your grandkids Google and find out, you know, about. But I was convinced at the time it was the right decision, and I'm convinced.
And you're still convinced.
Totally.
And it sounds like you have not lost a step in terms of what you're focusing on after that.
Success in life is just keep moving forward.
If you stop swimming, it's
I climbed for my 59th birthday. I climbed Kilimanjaro. And the locals have this expression pole, which means slow.
Right.
Slow.
Slow and
just
steady.
Just 1 foot in front of the other and keep moving forward.
How high is Kilimanjaro?
19,340 feet. But who's counting?
So you're still in the upper reaches of that. There's still elevation sickness and terrible weather.
Yeah.
I know Everest is 26 something.
I could never do that.
But that's supposed to be
a technical climb. Right.
People supposedly the last 5,000 feet of that are hallucinating and all
miserable.
Sorts of terrible things.
Yeah, no, I didn't want to be miserable, but this was not quite miserable, but strange.
How long did it take to this is news to me, by the way. This doesn't show up in any of our research about you. How long did it take to get to the top of Kilimanjaro? How long did it take to prep
there
for that?
We prepped for 6 months. But
really?
Yeah,
that's amazing.
Yeah, it wasn't strenuous prepping, but it was prepping. But there are two ways to go. You can go, and I've forgotten the names of the trails. You can go straight up the spine of the mountain,
right.
Or you can
loop around.
You can, cycle.
Which way
around.
Did you go?
The latter, because at 59, I wanted to acclimate as slowly as possible.
How long did it take to get to the top?
3 days.
3 days,
yeah.
And then back down?
Well, that's the interesting thing. The last day, you wake up at 10, 11 at night. I can't remember exactly when, because you want to walk up the glacial moraine while it's frozen.
Right.
So you don't slide back. You get to the peak at 6:30 in the morning when the sun's
coming
rising.
Up.
It's a spectacular view. Then you go back down to the camp that you
just
toboggan
straight down, or
you have a hard time lifting your legs at this point.
Oh, really?
I mean, the quads are just aching.
You're exhausted.
So you stop at 15,000 feet where you were the night before. You sleep for 2 hours, and then you go down to 12 or 10, I can't remember.
Just to acclimate the pressure difference on the way down.
And to get it all over with.
Okay.
It's an exhilaration to
really?
To believe you can do that.
The
you know, you're looking down on the clouds. It's but being a hedge fund guy, I of course had my satellite phone, and at the top of the mountain I had to call in to get quotes.
You were trading from the top of Mount Kilimanjaro.
I didn't trust my judgment enough, but I certainly wanted to be in touch.
Well, you had enough of your wits about you to know that you were not to be trusted.
I had a friend who once went to Africa for 2 weeks, came back, and the crash of 87 had occurred, mm-hmm. and he knew nothing about it during the whole time.
Really?
And that memory stayed with me. It's like,
wow.
you cannot do what I do and be removed from the world for that
he
long.
Missed the
he
1987.
Missed the whole thing.
You know, one of my favorite 87 stories is David Rosenberg's first day of work.
Mm-hmm.
He had been a government economist, and he went to work for, not Merrill Lynch, it was the job before that. His first day in the job mm-hmm. was the Black Monday.
Is that right?
Yeah, that was his first day. You guys talk about baptism by fire.
That is baptism.
So this guy's running a hedge fund. He goes to Africa in...
He didn't have a hedge fund. He's
running money.
But he was running money.
He goes in October, yeah. and he comes back, and what the hell happened?
And he calls from the airport in Nairobi, and they tell him and where the markets are, and he says, don't joke with me.
Right. This is too serious to
fool
around.
And they said, we're not kidding you. This is where things are. Yeah.
The flash crash in 2010, I took off from, I think it was Dallas, at mm-hmm. like 9 in the morning, New York time, and this was... There was no Wi-Fi on the flight because it was a short flight. And I land in, maybe it was Chicago, and I land in LaGuardia, and it was, what the hell happened? It was, wait, we're down 1,000 points, and now we're only down a few hundred? What? Like, I'm like, something's wrong with, I called somebody. Something's wrong with my phone. It's showing, no, you don't understand. It was 2:30 to 3.
Crazy.
Just absolutely insane. All right, so let's get to some of my favorite questions because I know... You have to have other places to go.
Witching hours approaching.
That's right. So who are your early mentors? Who really put the love of investing and both technology venture investing and asset management into you?
Good question. I mean, we're talking ancient history now.
I got it's lucky. Still valid.
I got out of Columbia and interviewed around, and I interviewed at Kidder, which you mentioned was the first job. There was a guy at Kidder at the time, Tom Folger, who was an MIT grad, mm-hmm. Who was director of research. He had hired about 6 months earlier a guy named Bob Johnson to follow computers, MIT, Harvard Business School.
Right.
And he hired me, and we formed the first sort of
group.
It was unheard of back in 67, 68, 69. And that was a kick. So, you know, if I had gotten, you know, recruited to follow the energy industry, I probably would have become a deep value energy buyer or something.
Right.
I don't know. But I got in with these guys who had a similar mindset, a similar approach. And so I would say that influenced me. And then I've always worked for a smaller firm. You are what you are. So, mm-hmm. you know, my first job out of college was Lockheed, which...
Not exactly a small firm.
Not exactly a small firm. Then I go down to Wall Street and I joined Kidder, which was a substantial firm at that time.
And Kidder eventually became... Kidder, Payne Weber or Dean Witter?
No. Didn't GE buy it?
I don't remember.
I think GE bought it and then sold it. But it disappeared. It was a great firm, but mm-hmm. it disappeared. I went from Kidder to a small firm by the name of Lombard Vitalis Paganucci and Nelson, which doesn't appear in any of the bio stuff any longer. It was there for all of 1 year, and then Weiss Peck & Greer was starting up.
Oh, sure.
It was a complete startup.
That's a big. That's now a decent sized firm, right?
They sold out to a Dutch bank, but I was the first hire after the partners opened the doors.
Mm-hmm.
Stayed there for 15 years, managed firm capital, had a pretty good record for 5 years, and went out and started the fund. So the investing part of it was, you know, a combination of my first job and then the venture experience at Weiss Peck and managing money. And I learned a lot about money management and cycles and money management, and I learned a lot. And I learned a lot by managing partners' capital.
And anybody stand out at Weiss Peck as a mentor?
My I don't know if you'd say mentor, but
influence.
So Byron Wien was
Byron's
been an investor was an investor when I had funds
mm-hmm.
From the very beginning. We had offices next to each other. I eventually came to work for Pequot as the chief strategist when he left Morgan Stanley's. Now with of course, at Blackstone. So Byron was one of them. There's unfortunately a fellow just passed away, by the name of Mickey Strauss, who I worked with there. So it was really more my colleagues than it was, you know, and sometimes you learn as much from colleagues as you do from
mentors. For sure.
Byron
was on the show. He's now in his early 80s.
Early 80s.
He still maintains a relentless travel schedule.
Yeah, I think he's crazy.
He flies to China all the time. He's all, like, I know people my age and younger who are like, oh, I can't travel that much. Yeah. He's on the road a week or two a month, like he's 26 right out of school.
Well, I don't think he's like 26 out of school, but he's, but yeah, no, he's an amazing, he's a warrior.
He's a warrior. He's 80 something. He's a warrior.
He's a warrior.
There's another guy who just loves what he does.
He loves what he does.
Nothing's going to stop him.
And we're still very close.
I'm going to ask about a book that I suspect you've read, and if you haven't, I'm going to recommend it.
Okay.
James Glick's The Information.
Nope.
But the history of information and theory, and that put that right
okay.
on the top of your list.
Okay.
Because you read enough interesting, eclectic stuff about both history and science.
Mm-hmm.
He's a brilliant writer. He's done the book Chaos about chaos theory.
Yeah.
That's him. And okay. this book is this should have won the Pulitzer. If it didn't, it may have.
Mm-hmm.
Just a brilliant. If you like that sort of stuff,
no,
and I suspect
I
you
do.
You're gonna find that. That fascinating. So let's talk a little bit about what's changed in the industry over the course of your career. What do you think, whether it's venture capital or traditional investing?
Everything has changed.
Everything. What's the more significant change?
I came down to Wall Street in 67.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there was the lost generation. Nobody came down to Wall Street in the 30s, 40s,
68
60s. 68
to 82.
People started to, you know, so is that luck or is that I followed what I thought my passion was? I don't know. I mean, I guess there's an element of luck to it. But so I got there at the beginning of the cycle.
Beginning of the bear market.
It was also the beginning of the market, yeah. So there was a bear market, as you know, from 70, 71 to 83.
The time period I like to use is the Dow kissed 1,000 in 1968.
Mm-hmm.
It did not eclipse that in 1966.
Mm-hmm.
66.
It
till 82.
Yeah.
So it was a full 16 years.
And those are my formative years. So right. Now, you know, you come in, the Fed keeps interest rates at zero, assets get inflated.
But that has to go up, though, doesn't it?
That
can
has
it
to
stay
go
at
up,
zero
but,
forever?
But a lot of people come in and you know, one of my mentors, there was a mentor that I forgot to mention, but said, you know, had the expression, which others have had, don't confuse brains with the
sure.
market. I really believe that. But, you know, so, but back then, you didn't just come into the market and the averages went up because the government decided they should go up or whatever's going on right now. Back then you had 15 years of nothing.
Right.
And you had to survive.
That's nominal. In real inflation adjusted, it was a big loser.
It was insane. And inflation was high, of course.
Right.
So, you know, that was my baptism.
Mm-hmm.
As it were.
Well, what was it like in the early 70s?
It sucked.
It sucked. That's an understatement. Obviously, the bond side was paying huge,
yes,
huge again nominal yields.
Yes,
but on the equity side, who was buying stocks?
There weren't that many, but you know, and that was all I did. I mean, I've never met a bond I like.
Right.
Which is not true, but
munis.
But
you could put some money away in munis.
Well, if I had been, you know, I knew the play, you know, when rates were up, you know, near 20% at the end of that period, and you know, we've had the biggest bond bull market ever.
30 years from 82 to 80, so, 82
and
to.
You could have bought zero coupons and paid no interest and made a fortune. But,
right.
You know, but I didn't do that, so I stuck with the stock thing, and it, you know, that was
that's worked out.
It's worked out enormously well, but it also means that I was a late bloomer. I mean, because you know, I put in 17 years before I started getting really paid back for my apprenticeship. I paid my dues,
but
I did it when I did it. I did it because I loved it,
mm-hmm.
and now I think people come in because they think they're going to get rich.
Well, that's always the wrong way to approach anything.
Yeah.
Right? If you're doing it for the money, then everything that's not putting money in your pocket is a misery.
Right.
If you're doing it because you love it, well, I'm not making money, but I'm having fun, so.
I like engineering enough, you know, but I like the discipline of it and the logic of it. But when you added to that the market and the uncertainty and the ability to try and outguess other people along with data, that became really exciting. It wasn't because I, you know, my dad was an electrician and I wanted to become a billionaire or something. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was the farthest thing from my mind. It happened. Truly just happened.
One of those things. So maybe you said before, I don't really think a lot about luck. How much of what happened was just serendipitous?
Fortuitous.
Serendipitous is the right word?
Yeah. No, that I agree with.
All right. But so you're slicing luck, the luck factor a little more.
Yeah,
right
I tend
place,
to do
right
that.
Time.
Yep.
And
no doubt.
Okay. So
no
so
doubt.
There's an element of luck to that.
Sure. That part is luck. I agree. But individual things I did or whatever.
Within
I,
that I, was a combination
I,
of.
I believe I created that.
That's a combination of smarts and hard work and application.
Yeah.
So we know lots and lots of stuff has changed in the past. What are some of the next shifts that you see in these industries from your vantage point, looking at technology and looking at the rate of change, which just seems to keep accelerating?
Yeah, I think you're in this fascinating, I mean, one of the reasons I drifted to venture capital is because markets have become the economy is matured.
Clearly.
So we have huge amounts of Social Security, pension funds, savings plans.
IRAs, 401ks, foundations, trusts.
You know, and anybody would say we're just awash in liquidity. And so it's got to go someplace. Mm-hmm. So it needs a big engine solution to how do you intelligently manage all these assets. Plus corporations in the U.S. at least. The one good thing about activism and all the other stuff is it's formed forced productivity that keep increasing in the United States, which has not been happening in the rest of the world.
Even though the measures of productivity in the U.S. are softer than a lot of people say, is that a measurement problem, or do we still have good productivity here?
I think we have good productivity. I think the economy is changing rapidly, and the productivity in the areas that generate growth, I think the productivity is good. And then in the areas that don't produce growth, capital is being returned. So the capital part is more productive. So we're awash in liquidity, there's not a lot of growth. In the U.S., the growth is obviously much slower than it used to be. So somebody has to manage all of that money.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not going to manage it by giving it to a guy like me back 30 years ago who was going to buy market caps under $200 million.
Right.
So, you know, you go to, you know, Ray Dalio's got a great engine and other people have great engines. So you go to these algorithmic kind of things that are more formulaic than what I ever used to do. So, you know, when you say what's going to go on in the future, I think that those trends are going to continue. I think this innovation that we're seeing is there's no stopping it. And
And what does that mean in terms of U.S. growth, the change of technology, and for the rest of the world economy?
I think it means.
Don't bet against it?
Well, for sure you don't bet against it, and you should bet with it. And there are going to be superior returns for people who fully understand it. Right now, it's the jealous or the envy factor is worked in, and so you're seeing all these comments on the unicorns and all that kind of stuff. You know, 10% of the unicorns will work, but they'll be monster companies. I think that's the wrong focus. These trends, there is no... There is no changing these trends. So the amount of liquidity in the system is going to continue to increase. The amount of growth is going to diminish. The growth is going to shift from old ways of doing things to new ways of doing things. And there's huge opportunities for me in what I now do. God knows if there would be any opportunities in what I used to do.
Okay, so we're running out of time. Let me get to the last two questions. These are my favorite questions.
Mm-hmm.
First, what sort of advice would you give to a millennial or a college graduate today if they were interested in going into either asset management or venture capital?
Get a job.
Really?
Yeah.
Just find some related job and plow into it.
Just get a job in an industry. I would not come into this industry fresh out. I didn't. I went and worked in the aerospace industry for 3 years.
So get some other sort of tech experience and then use that.
Yep.
And then last question, what do you know about the world of investing today that you wish you knew when you began 40 years ago?
Oh, well, that's I knew nothing 40 years ago. I mean, I was I was a wet behind the ears ex-college student, aeronautical engineer, got in a carpool with Gabelli and Cooperman, got fascinated by markets, which I had been a little bit interested in before, but I didn't know diddly.
So everything you know today. Art, thank you so much for being so generous with your time. This has really been a fascinating conversation. And I really appreciate you spending so much time with us today.
I appreciate the opportunity to tell the story.
You've been listening to Masters in Business. I want to thank our engineer, Ken, my producer, Charlie, and my head of research, Mike Batnick. If you enjoy this conversation, look up an inch or down an inch on iTunes, and you could see the other 60 such conversations we've had. Be sure and check out my daily column on BloombergView.com. or the big picture at Ritholtz.com. Follow me on Twitter at Ritholtz. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You've been listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio.